This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. How aware are you of the influence of pop culture on young people today? I recently learned of a particular pop star who is promoting some ideas and beliefs that shocked me, and it's just increased my awareness of how damaging some of these ideas are to our teens. I have three kids, including a 14-year-old daughter, and it's really people her age that are being targeted by this type of stuff. We're going to talk about pop stars on the scene today who are promoting a new level of vulgarity and sexual ambiguity to young people. We've been talking a lot about European nations taking in the flood of immigrants and refugees from the Middle East. Well, another major destination for many of these people is Turkey. So far, it's one of the few nations neighboring Syria that is willing to take people in. It's taken in nearly 2 million refugees. Shane Granger recently traveled there, and he saw a number of these people, and we're going to talk with him about his experience and get a firsthand look at this situation. Asia is making big waves in the world news, especially the great nations of Russia and China, thanks to economic and military moves that are making waves throughout the region and worldwide. For 16 years, the Philadelphia Church of God has produced a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. This is a terrific little booklet that helps you to understand this region and what to expect from it in the time ahead. Well, current events there are really backing up the forecasts that we made in this booklet 16 years ago. We're just finishing up a revision and an expansion of this booklet in order to include the most recent important developments. You're going to want to get a copy of this booklet. We're willing to send it to you for free. And on the program today, we're going to talk to Jeremiah Jacques about the updated version of this booklet and what we can learn from it. Then at the end of the program, we'll take a little lesson from a couple of babies in Namibia. We'll see what makes them fight, and we'll learn the secret to harmony and peace. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Pop culture has long been a driving influence in teenage morality, and adults have been complaining about it for decades, back to Elvis shaking his hips on Ed Sullivan. But wow, is it ever getting bad now? Maybe you're like me and don't pay a lot of attention to these things, but guess what? An awful lot of people do pay attention. That's what puts the pop in pop culture. And what are they learning? What sorts of messages are they getting? Brace yourself. One pop superstar is Miley Cyrus. She became a sensation as a young teen when she was cast in the Disney Channel TV series Hannah Montana. She gained a huge following among young girls in particular. The year after that, she produced an album, her first album. It went quadruple platinum. That's 4 million copies. She's had 24 songs in the U.S. Hot 100. 14 of those were in the top 40. At age 19, she was the richest teen in Hollywood after she made $120 million that year. Last year, she won Billboard Music's Top Streaming Artist of the Year Award. She won MTV's Video of the Year. The World Music Awards crowned her the best female artist, the world's best female artist, and named her the world's most talked about artist on Facebook. On Twitter, she has 22.4 million followers, more than CNN, more than the New York Times. More than 47 million admirers have liked her Facebook page. So this woman is influential. She's in the spotlight. And she knows it. She likes to think of herself as a philanthropist. She supports several charities and health organizations. She's an advocate for animal rights and help for the homeless. She's known for her charitable work. And compared to a lot of celebrities, she's generous with her time and money for causes she supports. So I'm sure there are a lot of people who admire her for her charity work. But what she's really known for are her vulgarity, her profanity, her over-the-top exhibitionism. She's well known for using marijuana. She's said that cannabis is the best drug on earth, and she's also an advocate of ecstasy or Molly, which she has called a happy drug. She's well known for her revealing outfits, for her raunchiness. To her 22.4 million Twitter followers, she regularly tweets sexually explicit pictures of herself. Miley Cyrus has been talking about her sexuality a lot lately. In an interview in just the last couple of weeks, she called herself pansexual. Now, what is pansexual? A Yahoo News article about it gave a definition from a PhD, the associate director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. This is what this news article says. It's different from bisexuality, she explains, because bisexuality suggests that there are just two genders. Pansexuals, on the other hand, are open to the idea of being drawn to people who are genderqueer or transgender, as well as those who identify as male or female. It just widens the scope, this woman explains. Miley told One Magazine recently, "I'm not in a relationship. I'm 22. I'm going on dates. But I change my style every 2 weeks, let alone who I'm with." She said in another recent interview, "I am literally open to every single thing that is consenting and doesn't involve an animal and everyone is of age. Everything that's legal, I'm down with. Yo, I'm down with any adult, anyone over the age of 18 who is down to love me. I don't relate to being boy or girl, and I don't have to have my partner relate to boy or girl." I've never heard the term pansexual before reading about this, but I'm sure that this type of thinking isn't totally new. It's been around for a while, and this certainly isn't the first time that you've had a high-profile celebrity who has made some highly questionable lifestyle choices. But I have never known of someone so influential, so mainstream, so widely accepted, who was such a vocal advocate of this level of immorality. There have been weird celebrities. There have been fringe pop stars who attracted fringe audiences with antics along these lines. And I'm sure there were mainstream pop artists who were into some terrible behavior as well, but they were more private about it. They didn't want to damage their public reputation or their appeal to a mainstream audience. But this woman is about as mainstream as you get. And her audience is young single men and women and teenagers and kids, and she's teaching them. She is teaching them. She's indoctrinating them. She's setting an example for them by the millions. And the longer she's in the limelight, the weirder she gets. And I'm sure that there is still weirder to come if it's possible. And this is just as the issue of gender confusion is blowing up in our society. We recently had an article on thetrumpet.com with the title, "Half of Britain's Young People Say They're Not 100% Heterosexual." This is what that article said. A recent survey conducted by the research firm YouGov found that only 46% of young people in Britain ages 18 to 24 would classify themselves as 100% heterosexual. 46%. The survey used a scale which plots people on a range of 0 to 6 based on their own sexual inclinations, 0 being exclusively heterosexual and 6 being exclusively homosexual. The majority of young Britons believe that sexual orientation is something more fluid and ambiguous rather than something fixed and concrete. And it's a whole lot more clear to me why that's the case when you hear people like Miley Cyrus coming out and making such outrageous statements as those that she made. What is going on? What sort of society would we have if everyone conducted themselves like this pop star is? No interest in long-term relationships, no interest in marriage or family, just bouncing around from one liaison to another and changing partners and changing sexual preferences every 2 weeks and trying to find something new to titillate you for just that particular moment. The most important thing is just gratifying the self. She says, I'm down with anyone over the age of 18 who's down to love me. Now, anyone who thinks like that has no idea what love is. Love is just down to physical gratification, no emotional connection, no significant mental connection, no commitment, no giving of yourself, no personal sacrifice. What she's describing is opposite of love. It's the absolute opposite. And how many people is she leading into this destructive thinking, this destructive mindset, these destructive personal choices and life-altering mistakes? Last month, a polling company called Voucher Cloud said that 78% of British parents called Miley Cyrus the worst celebrity influence for children. But I'm sure in her view, there's no such thing as bad publicity. She views any publicity as fantastic. I'm sure she loves hearing people like me talking about what an appalling influence this is on our young people and on our society. Recently, a woman named Chrissy Hynde, she was the lead singer for The Pretenders. She's 64 years old now. Last week on a BBC show, she was talking about Miley Cyrus and other pop stars of her ilk. And she said this younger generation of pop stars, highly sexualized pop stars, basically she said they're like prostitutes. She accused them of not just going along with the porn culture that we see in our society, but she actually said that they're encouraging rape culture with the way that they dress, the way that they dance, the way that they conduct themselves. This is what she said. It's provoked by this pornography culture. It's provoked by pop stars who call themselves feminists. They're selling their music by bumping and grinding and wearing their underwear in videos. I would say those women are responsible for a great deal of damage. Now, that seems like a fairly common sense statement to make. But guess what? People criticized her, excoriated her for what they called whorephobia. People are outraged at the suggestion that a woman who dresses skimpily and dances the way these women dance, that they might actually be contributing to problems in society, or that they would be doing something to contribute to men mistreating them in any way. In their view, a woman should be able to do whatever she wants, that she can be as provocative as she wants to be, and that's just society has to deal with it. Well, this is where modern feminism has come to. If you criticize anything a woman chooses to do with her body, well, then you're being patronizing, you're being misogynistic. If you even say that prostitution is wrong, then you are anti-feminist. How crazy has the thinking become in our society? How crazy is this influence of pop culture? It has gotten so bizarre and destructive, especially what you see among younger people. We're several generations down the track from the sexual revolution, and the further we go, the more perverse, the more nonsensical, the more destructive, the more anti-family this movement becomes. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote a book in the early 1980s called The Missing Dimension in Sex, and he addresses the influence of teenagers on culture. There's a whole section in there called the teenage influence, the teen influence. He says few people stop to realize to what extent the teenagers have taken over. They pretty well dominate the world picture. Now, of course, he actually wrote this even earlier than the 1980s, but We're several generations down from that. I mean, the woman who was criticizing them, she was a teenager probably at the time that Herbert Armstrong wrote that book. But he wrote this, and it's just so much worse today. He said, "What many do not realize is that this teenage influence on the whole society is predominantly sexual influence. There is a much more intense preoccupation with sex during these years than in later maturity. Therefore, sex became the basic formula for motion pictures, along with violence and crime, including murder." And of course, today you've got several other media. You've got music videos and all kinds of videos and images and music that is available in so many different forms. It is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. And it is a predominantly sexual influence, and it is a very destructive influence. I was reading an article about Katy Perry, who is another one of these stars who's kind of in the same mold as Miley Cyrus. And she was talking about how important therapy is to her. She says, "Therapy is a safe place for me to actually work out everything that's going on inside by a person who knows me as Catherine Hudson, not as Katy Perry." She said, "I would say that anyone that's in this business should be doing that regularly, to have that kind of accountability, because you get to a place where, like, no one holds you accountable. You can do anything you want, and it's so destructive." That's what Katy Perry says. The place where you get to the point where you can do anything you want and no one holds you accountable and there are no boundaries, no one is checking you, you just go with whatever you feel like doing, she says, it's so destructive. She's been there and she has seen this and she's seen what it's done to her, and she's trying to figure out, who am I? She's trying to remember the person that she once was, because she's gotten so far away from that, and she can recognize, she can see to at least some extent just how personally destructive that kind of a mentality and that kind of a lifestyle really is. Look at what happened to Miley Cyrus. She didn't start out weird. She's just become more and more perverse the deeper she's gotten into this. And the whole business just seems like it has a very destructive influence on everyone who has any deep involvement in it. Anyone who goes the path that she is going to make the same journey that she's making. There are millions of young people who are going to end up like this poor woman. And our whole society is much the worse for it. You can read more about this trend, including what God says about it and where it's taking American society, by reading our article online, "Miley Cyrus is Like a Wrecking Ball." Find it on thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We've been talking a lot about European nations taking in this flood of immigrants from the Middle East. Well, Turkey has also been a big destination for many of these refugees, or certainly at least a transit point. And so far, it has taken in nearly 2 million of these refugees and immigrants, 2 million that it has documented. Shane Granger recently traveled to Turkey, and he saw a number of these refugees in the city of Izmir. This is in the far west of Turkey. They've traveled a long way from where they came from. And I have Shane with me here in the studio to talk about his experience. Hello, Shane.
Good afternoon.
So what did you see when you were over there?
Well, we traveled through a lot of Turkey, from Istanbul through to the central Anatolian plateau, Cappadocia, and then all the way to the west to the Aegean. And we had heard that there were Syrian refugees in Turkey. We just didn't see any until we got to Izmir. And as we pulled up to our hotel at night, we just saw hundreds of people across the street in a park-like median there in the center part of the city. And we were, you know, kind of surprised to see that many people out late at night. It was after midnight when our bus came in. And our tour guides told us, well, these are the refugees. And so we thought, oh, aha, they're, you know, we're finally seeing quite a few of them. And there were a lot of them. So that was a bit of a surprise that evening.
I guess you interacted with them the following day. You got some kind of a sense of what they were coming from and what it was that drove them out of where their home countries to want to go to Turkey.
Yes, well, we found a couple of interpreters who could help us, and you know, we're asking questions about where are you from and why are you here and so forth. And what we heard were some pretty harrowing stories. The refugees were mostly from northern Syria, and they told us that the conditions had just gotten so bad there in their hometowns that they felt like they just couldn't stay any longer. And one man said, "Well, for example, when we go to the mosques to pray, when the call to prayer goes out and we're going, the Assad's forces would wait until the people got to the mosque to pray, and then they would start bombing the mosques. So they were targeting civilians. As we saw throughout Turkey, I mean, when Muslims go to the mosque, they don't go, it's not just the men. I mean, they take the children with them. Often the women are have a place there as well to pray. You know, the fact that you can't even go and worship and without fear of being bombed begins to really impact you in a way that causes you to say, well, you know, do I need to get out of here? And clearly they were experiencing things that were traumatic enough where they felt like, well, they just had to leave.
So are they leaving with a destination in mind? Turkey is one of several neighboring countries, and it's been the most willing to take these folks in. Are they planning to stay there, or why Turkey versus some of the other countries around there, or is it on their way somewhere else?
Well, the refugees that we spoke to all said that they wanted to go to Germany, and this was before Germany was in the news. This was in late July, and so I remember thinking, well, why would you want to go to Germany? I mean, and they were specific. They weren't saying to Europe or anything. They all said, you know, Germany, and it was clear that was the destination. And I wondered, well, why wouldn't you stay here in Turkey? Clearly, geographically, Turkey is, of course, a neighbor with Syria, and it's easier to cross the border there in the north, although some of the refugees told us about the crossing the areas where the minefields are and how dangerous that is. But nevertheless, it is the easiest place for them to go, to cross the border into Turkey and then make their way to far western Turkey there on the Aegean. And they all said, well, we want to go to Germany, and the Aegean is the gateway to Europe. If we can just get to Greece, we're in Europe, and then we're on our way. And so I felt like none of the people that we talked with had any intention of staying in Turkey. And to me, that was surprising.
So Turkey they've been keeping track of these folks as they've been coming into the country, and they, by their own numbers, they say it's nearly 2 million. But as far as you could tell, it's not necessarily 2 million people that plan to remain within Turkey. It's just they're there for the time being.
Correct. And I think because the Syrians, there are a lot of ethnic Turks in Syria. There are a lot of, I think they have been absorbed into Turkey in homes and in, you know, families and extended families and things like that. They're certainly not out on the streets. Now, in Istanbul, we did see some Syrian refugees in Istanbul on the streets, asking for money and for help. But there was not near the number that we saw down in Izmir on the Aegean. So I think that the documented numbers, nearly 2 million that Turkey has taken in, they've provided camps for them, they've provided homes for them, and they've assimilated them into other areas. They're not on the streets. I mean, these are not homeless people that have been documented. They obviously have somewhere to stay. But it's the ones who are transiting through Turkey toward Europe and wanting to go to Germany that we saw in the streets, as you've seen on all the news media here in the last few weeks.
What's the response within Turkey to this crisis? We've been talking so much about just what a crisis this is creating within Europe, and just all of the hand wringing and this division between those who feel so obligated to help out in whatever way, and then those who are really concerned about financial costs, about cultural costs, and religious influence among these people, not to mention the possibility of radicals or terrorists entering in among this flood of individuals. Within Turkey, is there that kind of internal discussion going on?
Well, I think what's interesting is that even the people who are critical of the Turkish government and of Erdogan's administration give them credit for how they've handled the refugee crisis. They set up a prime ministry specifically to deal with the refugee crisis, and that ministry meets often. They hold press conferences often and discuss, you know, the problems that they're facing and the needs and where things are. So even the critics of the government there say, look, we have to give credit where credit is due. They've done a good job of managing this. A recent press conference was held on the 23rd or 24th of August by the prime ministry of that's dealing with the crisis. And in that, they talked about the need for understanding and for tolerance, even amongst Turkish citizens. There are those who don't want the Syrians there, and they have caused some issues, and there's been attacks and things on some of the camps and places like that, and even protests in some areas. And the prime ministry is taking the lead and saying, look, we all need to realize that these people have nowhere else to go, and it is up to us to welcome them and everybody, you know, take a step back and calm down, and let's make sure that we keep the peace, so to speak, between the refugees and the Turkish people. So it's interesting that they are showing a great amount of leadership in that area. And there doesn't seem to be too much concern, at least from what I heard and what I saw and have read since, that there's a security risk or anything there.
Turkey doesn't seem like it's really a big target among, say, the more radical groups there. And
that's right.
I don't know. Turkey is demographically, obviously, vastly Muslim, although there's a strong secularist trend in there in the country as well, but I could see there not being quite as much concern about just the cultural and religious aspect of the story.
I think the interesting thing about Turkey, if you look at ethnic conflict there, it's really not with the Syrians at all. It's with the Kurds, and that is where the Erdogan government is getting a lot of criticism, not only from outside, but Turkey, but also Turkish citizens themselves. They're very concerned about that.
What's your sense of the general feeling in Turkey? Just the country's obviously changed a lot under Erdogan's administration, and over the past decade politically, he's been making efforts to take a lot more power to himself. How do the Turks feel about that?
Well, I asked a lot of people that I met about that. I was curious because the government has been predominantly ruled by the ruling party for about a decade now, and they've always gotten the majority in parliament, and so they've had a mandate to rule. But constitutionally, Erdogan is limited, and so he switched positions, much like Vladimir Putin did, is now trying to rewrite portions of the Constitution to be able to extend his ability to stay in power. And in order to do that, he needs a majority in parliament. What happened is with the elections that occurred in July, the pro-Kurdish party won 13% of the vote. And by Turkish law, if you get at least 10% of the vote, you have a representation in parliament. And so what that did was that split the vote, and it robbed Erdogan and his government of their majority. What a lot of the Turkish people told me that I spoke to was that they believe that the uptick in violence and the uptick in attacks on the Kurds and between the Kurds and the Turkish government
within Turkey itself,
which began happening while we were there. They had had a truce for they had a number of years, and it was a big deal. You know, they finally settled, had a ceasefire and had a truce and so forth. And then while I was there, the announcement came out that the United States was going to start using the Incirlik Air Base to bomb targets in Syria and Iraq. And, my first thought was, well, what did Turkey ask for in return? And I think the answer was, of course, they wanted to be able also to operate out of and begin bombing targets in the area. What we found out, though, was that they started bombing Kurdish targets more than they were interested in ISIS. And the people said, oh, well, this is all political. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, because the Kurdish party essentially split the vote, if he can continue through August the 23rd without forming a coalition, being unable to form a coalition government, then he will have to call for new elections. And so what we believe he's doing is that he's demonizing the Kurds so that in the next election, which will now take place, I believe, in November, the Kurdish vote will get down below the 10% threshold, and his ruling party will have the ability to go ahead and push through the reforms that they want to keep them in power.
Are they upset at this sort of Putin power play that Erdogan is making? It seems like I don't hear a lot of opposition against it. I just wonder if it's a matter of them just not having a lot of tools in their arsenal to be able to do anything about it.
Well, you certainly don't see it in the state, in the state media, but you do see it in some of the independent media there as well. We talked with both news writers and with television station that are some of the largest independent, media outlets in Turkey, and they were all very concerned about it and were trying to, make a case for people standing up for, their human rights and so forth. And in fact, the TV station there in Istanbul told us that they, if they put a program on or something that the government doesn't like, the government doesn't have the power to shut them down, but they can come in and find some picky little piece of
make life difficult
and then slap them with exorbitant fees or things like that to make a point that, hey, we don't like what you're saying. So there are voices there that are very concerned about what he is doing and the direction that is going. And so the question will be, well, who, which one is going to win out? And that's yet to be seen, I suppose.
Turkey is such an interesting country, and it's right there kind of at the crossroads of between Europe and the Middle East, and culturally and politically, it's always kind of played this middle ground. It has a very interesting role in end-time biblical prophecy. We've talked about that quite a lot on thetrumpet.com. It'll be interesting to see how these things play out and just these the trends that we're seeing now politically, even demographically, how that's going to factor into Turkey's future. We sure appreciate you taking the time to come here. We've been talking with Shane Granger. He's just returned from a trip to Turkey and wrote an article on thetrumpet.com called A Firsthand Look at Syria's Refugee Crisis. Look for it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Shane, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Two nations that are in the news a lot these days are Russia and China. Russia under Vladimir Putin stirring up trouble, seizing territory in Eastern Europe, and China, which has become such an economic juggernaut that it can cause global panic just by fiddling with its currency. It's more and more important that we really understand these two countries and where these trends are heading, and it makes a particular piece of literature produced by the Philadelphia Church of God extremely relevant, and that is the booklet Russia and China in Prophecy. This booklet was first produced 16 years ago, back in 1999. We've distributed about 130,000 copies of this booklet over the years. We've updated it a few times. The last time was in 2009, but our editorial team is just finishing up a new revision, an expansion of this booklet, and it's turning into quite a substantial booklet. The man who's been spearheading this effort to bring it right up to date is our man watching Asia, Jeremiah Jacques, and he's here to tell us about what we can learn from this booklet. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
First of all, can you give us just a summary of what Russia and China in Prophecy is about?
Yes, it starts at the very beginning with the progenitors of these two nations back in Genesis, right alongside the revelation there about who the fathers of the modern Israelitish nations are, is a revelation also about who the fathers of many of the modern nations that we see in Asia are. So we see the identity of the people who would become China, for the most part, revealed there, and then also the people that would become modern-day Russians. And so in the book, we really spend some time just going through some of those prophecies, which are mostly in Genesis, at least concerning the earliest origins, but also scattered throughout other passages in the Bible. So just to show that the Bible is not silent about these massive nations that we see on the planet now. It starts with that, and then it gets into a little bit about Russia specifically. There's a chapter 2 is devoted to Russia's role in Bible prophecy, and especially zeroing in on the way it frightens Europe and really plays an instrumental role in galvanizing European unification. And then there's a lot of that regarding a clash between Europe and Russia, which we have not yet seen. That still lies ahead on the prophetic timeline. Chapter 3 is about China and just this astounding rise to power that we've seen from this nation that just a couple of generations ago was just a lot of rice farmers out in the paddies there. It was a fairly backward, not industrialized nation. And then suddenly you look at it today and it is just an astounding powerhouse. Like you mentioned, it can send economic reverberations throughout the world. It can send the world into panic just because of some tremors that may happen in its market there. And then there's also a chapter about Japan's place in the future. And then a lot at the end just about what still lies ahead with Asia in prophecy. And then I'm hoping that we may be able to add a chapter about India as well. It's something that, especially since Vladimir Putin's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula there in Ukraine and the other expansionist activities that he's spearheading, India has been just unbelievably supportive of all that in a way that we have had a lot of information in the previous editions about India and its role in this end time power block of Russia and China. But now it just seems like it's emerged as such a powerful nation and such a staunch supporter of Russia that maybe we'd be able to give it a few more pages in there.
So the last major revision of the booklet was 2009. A lot has happened in the 6 years between 2009 and today in Asia, and the headlines from Asia have been very dramatic. Can you give us an idea of what has happened geopolitically that you've had to acknowledge in the revision?
Sure. Yeah, well, the big thing is, as I mentioned there earlier, Crimea. We saw in the 21st century, we saw a nation redraw the map in Europe. I mean, just something that people would have laughed about, the very idea of it. If you'd said, yeah, Russia's going to come and just take part of a European nation, if you'd suggested that a few years earlier. But that was a momentous geopolitical development. And it has caused a lot of concern in Europe, among European nations, especially the Baltics and weaker states. They're saying, Germany, protect us. All these other nations, we need to put our militaries together. We need to have a unified response to this. We can't let Vladimir Putin's Russia continue this sort of thing. So in Europe, the response, it's still happening. And it's happening perhaps slowly in some ways, but it really is galvanizing unification there. But then the result of that same maneuver in Asia has been just the opposite. While the United States and Europe were quick to try to punish Russia and slap all these sanctions on them and stop doing a lot of various economic activities with Russia, Asia has said, you know what, Mr. Putin, we have your back. If you're losing out on trade with the Western Hemisphere, just look east. We're right here and we're ready to redouble our efforts of all sorts of trade deals. And they have, both India and China especially, have increased all kinds of trade with Russia in response to that. So what you see as a result of that annexation of Crimea is a really rapidly deepening geopolitical fault line between East and West. And it's just something that has really influenced every chapter of this book.
Well, what's interesting about those trends that you're talking about is that all of the points were there in the booklet, and these events that have happened subsequent to the last revision are confirming the prophecies as they were spelled out in the booklet already.
That's exactly right. Just before that 2009 update, our listeners may recall that Russia had invaded Georgia, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, really drew a lot of attention to that in a way that not that many analysts and pundits did, maybe.
Specifically the effect on Europe in terms of catalyzing, we need a response to Russia's aggression.
Yes, that's right. He drew a lot of attention to that. And then he also said that it signals a dangerous new era. I think that's the headline of an article that he wrote, Russia's attack on Georgia signals a dangerous new era. And in that article, he said, I believe Ukraine is next. I think that Mr. Putin will not sit idly by as NATO continues to expand toward Russia, as it continues to try to coax Ukraine away from Russia and into Europe's orbit. Mr. Fleury said, I don't think that Russia's going to let that happen. And then here we are a few years later, and that is precisely what happened.
So in the 2009 edition, it had the material from Mr. Fleury about the Georgia attack and the effect on Europe. And did it have that statement from Mr. Fleury? I know he put it in the trumpet. Did we put it in the booklet?
I believe it was in the booklet. I would have to, right now, I've just been looking at the newer version, and we definitely have it in there. But I'm fairly certain that it was also in the 2009 update.
So going back to those statements from Gerald Fleury in 2009 or before that, when the Georgia attack happened, it makes those statements all the more relevant. It makes those statements, I mean, you really recognize the prescience of those statements at that time.
It was stunning how accurate that forecast was. And we actually had to shorten that part of the new booklet because we had really put a lot of Mr. Fleury's material about Russia's attack on Georgia in there. But in light of what happened with Ukraine,
subsequent events kind of overtook even what happened at that time.
Exactly. So it's not that the Georgian attack was not important, but we had to condense that a little bit to make room for these other things that are just really even more significant.
So we've kind of gotten a sense of this, but maybe you could just give us more of a sense of how events that have happened subsequent to 2009 have fallen in line with the biblical prophecies that we cover in this booklet.
Yeah, I would say across the board, you can see, like, for example, we have a chapter about China's rise. And there's a section in here that just really lays some numbers out, some staggering numbers. Look at this. And we had to go through that and revise every one of those figures up, in some cases, 200-300%.
Amazing.
So it was, you know, we drew attention to the number of nuclear power reactors that were in operation. And so we said, they have 11 nuclear power reactors. In the new version, we had to replace that with 26. Mm. And that's, you know, just a few years later.
So, you know, what's interesting, I think this is a pretty remarkable example of how if you're looking at current events through that lens of biblical prophecy, you're going to be focusing on the right trends. You know, you're going to be focusing on the things that really are actually going to become more and more significant over time. And here, subsequent events have vindicated the fact that we were looking at those things and writing chapters in a booklet about that.
That's true. I feel like in many ways, our news-watching job at The Trumpet is far easier than it would be for other journalists, because we know what to look for. We know what to expect. We have incredible insider's information just about what sorts of major geopolitical shifts and trends and whatnot will happen. And this update has really confirmed that for me. As I look through it and say, here's something that we said, watch out for this, just about every case, it has happened. So in the updated version, we're able to write that even more strongly. Look what has happened now, even in the last 6 years since it was updated.
Any other eye-popping examples you can share with us?
I would say, I did mention this earlier, but probably in the earlier version, we said it's very likely that India will also be a part of this power block.
And but didn't necessarily have a lot of proof to back it up. It was just basically going off of what to expect from Scripture.
That's right. Yes. And in this version, there's no shortage of really concrete evidence. They just got a new prime minister who was elected last year, I believe, Narendra Modi. And he, unlike his predecessor, is cool toward the West and very, very oriented toward the Orient. He's really friendly with Russia in particular. And then with even with China, we're seeing a lot of big steps toward reconciliation in what has historically been a pretty heated, a pretty tense relationship, especially right there at the border of India and China. But if you look at India today, as compared to what it was when we last updated the booklet in 2009, you say, wow, it really has happened that this monolithic nation, 1.2 billion people, you know, the second most populous in the world, third largest army, actually, is now suddenly, it's very easy to see it very much allying itself with Russia.
So you're on the tail end of this process. Any idea when we might expect to be able to get our hands on a copy?
We're probably approaching 90% completion right now. So I would imagine that I'll be able to hand it off to you within the next week.
Okay, fantastic. And maybe we've got a little bit of a break coming up over the next few weeks, but maybe within the next couple of months, we should be able to have a copy back from the printer. No promises. We don't really know. Things happen once they leave our department, then the other people get their hands on them, and it takes a little while for the process to play itself out. But
and who knows what other Eastern European country might be invaded before we send it to printers, and then we'll have to revise it again.
You can get the current version of Russia and China in Prophecy online at thetrumpet.com, and keep your eyes peeled for this expanded, revised version. Looking forward to it, Jeremiah. Thanks for the news.
Thank you.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Back in 2010, a movie came out called Babies. I never saw the movie. I think it was basically a documentary about babies growing up, but I just saw the trailer. But I will never forget the opening shot of this trailer. In this unscripted scene, a boy and a girl are both maybe 8 months old, calmly sitting side by side in a hut in Namibia, Africa. The girl notices an empty plastic bottle on the ground in front of the boy. She grabs it. He protests by pushing her hand away. She cries out and looks up. She's hoping an adult will intervene, and no one does. So she leans over and bites the boy's shoulder. He howls and begins hitting her. And when she fails to react, he throttles her by the neck. She screams, and he immediately goes back to his activity as if oblivious to her suffering. But he gives a sidelong glance to make sure he escaped parental scrutiny. The girl, alone in her despair, flops forward with her face in her arms. And then in one final comic insult, when she coughs, a cloud of dust flies in her face. It's really funny, but it's also kind of distressing. In less than 40 seconds, these two children depict the tragicomic story of humankind. We covet, we take things by force, we retaliate, we escalate silly feuds, we dodge responsibility, we lack concern for others, we deceive, we cover our tracks, we sulk, we pity ourselves. Watching it unfold between infants is funny because it's so universal and it's so plainly absurd. This is our human nature. Human nature is selfish. You have it, I have it, just as surely as those two babies in the African desert have it. And it plays out in several ways in our lives. Just like those children, our relationships are beset by conflict and hurt because of that self-oriented nature. Selfishness is at the root of untold human suffering. The comedy in a childish spat disappears when our human nature plays out among bigger people with higher stakes, causing greater suffering. Relationship problems stem from breaking the basic spiritual law of give. Whenever someone puts himself ahead of the other, you end up with problems. In all relationships, wherever you see discord, self-love is at the root. But amazingly, modern society stupidly encourages self-love. Parents have come to think that their number one job is to nurture their children's self-esteem. We avoid discipline and we teach our preschoolers to say, "I'm special, look at me." We give students higher grades for less work. Sports programs award trophies just for participating. Thanks to reality TV, we have a generation of fame seekers. Celebrity obsession has turned vanity into a virtue. Facebook, MySpace, YouTube, these facilitate self-promotion. Society is experiencing a boom in self-admiration. Well, guess what? All this self-love is making us miserable. And yet you still have people who look at the strife and the spiritual emptiness that result from too much self. And they'll tell you the real problem is insufficient self-esteem. Modern culture says you have to love yourself in order to love others. But it's far more accurate to say that self-love kills the ability to love others. Studies have actually shown that the more narcissistic people become, the greater their tendency to lack emotionally warm, caring, loving relationships. The more self-love we have, the less room there is in our hearts for actual love, that is, genuine outgoing concern for others. James 4, verses 1 and 2 ask, "What causes wars, and what causes fightings among you? Is it not your passions that are at war in your members? You desire and do not have, so you kill, and you covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and wage war." There's a lot in that passage. Pursuing self-interest over the greater good, that's really the source of all conflict, whether it's international war or a childish feud over an empty plastic bottle. The solution is the diametric opposite of the self. It is the law of God. Jesus Christ expressed the spirit of this law as two simple commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. All the specific laws that God gave against killing and hatred, against coveting and materialism, against sexual immorality and so on, they're all just expressions of this overarching principle of love. God's law and his way of life are always giving, outflowing, thoughtful, selfless. Yes, we need to take care of ourselves. That's part of the love your neighbor as yourself formulation. But that isn't putting the self ahead of others. God's way is opposite the self-love that brings sorrow and suffering, discouragement and frustration, conflict and contention. The way of love is the way of happiness, of joy, satisfaction, and harmony in relationships. That's not our natural way. In fact, Romans 8 and verse 7 says, "Our human nature is enmity against God, for it's not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be." That's why you see the selfishness that leads to contention in every corner of the world, even in a little hut with a couple of eight-month-olds. In the heart of every person on earth smolders the love of the self. Today's society, rather than trying to control those flames, fans and stokes them into a wildfire. Don't follow that trend. Strive to douse self-love in yourself and in your children by practicing and teaching love toward God and love toward others. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. There you can read the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter at @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus by searching Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Shane Granger and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from William Faulkner. The man who removes a mountain begins by carrying away small stones. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice 101.3 KPCG and on the web at kpcg.fm.